From Cortland, New York, America's smallest small city, it's the Nerd Bomber Podcast, featuring the best news, entertainment, and related discussion that pop culture has to offer. And now, your hosts and experts in anti-social media, Just Jamie and your friend Claude! Ladies, gentlemen, millennials, welcome to the Nerd Bomber Podcast. I'm your friend Claude, here as usual with...
the raspy voice of Just Jamie.
And today's episode is about our favorite childhood reading experiences, our fondest memories of the books and magazines from our youth. But first, we have some very current business to attend to. If you remember back to our game show episode from last month, we each predicted Oscar winners in 19 different categories. Well, the 92nd Annual Academy Awards was held last night, as we record this. So that means the time has come to find out how we did. And let's get right to it. We're going to proceed in the order that we made the predictions on the last show, so they will match up. That's called continuity. And starting off like we did last time with... best actor in a leading role. Jamie, who did you pick?
I picked Mr. Joaquin Phoenix.
As did I. And the winner was Mr. Joaquin Phoenix.
Woohoo!
Right out of the gate, we were one for one.
All right.
Actor in a supporting role, Jamie picked?
Al Pacino.
I picked Brad Pitt. And the winner ended up being Brad Pitt.
No.
His first ever Oscar win of any kind. Best film editing is next. Jamie picked...
The Irishman.
I picked Joker. Yeah, you'll see a trend. The winner, however, was Ford versus Ferrari. Neither one of us got that right. Makeup and hairstyling. Jamie picked...
Judy.
I picked Joker again. However, the winner was a movie called Bombshell. So we failed two in a row.
Ooh.
Best original score. Who did you pick?
Little Women.
I went with 1917, and the winner was, this time it was Joker. That's three in a row we failed on.
Four for me, by the way.
The next category was Best Original Song, and I think our fortunes are going to turn around here.
Here we go.
Because we both picked I'm Gonna Love Me Again by Elton John, and the winner, of course, was I'm Gonna Love Me Again by Elton John.
All right.
Best Picture. Jamie, you picked...
1917.
I went with Marriage Story. However, the winner was Parasite.
A shocking upset.
Indeed, the record-setting first ever foreign language film to win the Best Picture Award.
Indeed.
I think we're both happy to be wrong on that one.
That's kind of cool.
Best sound editing, you had?
Ford versus Ferrari.
And I gave it to Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. But Jamie came out on top this time. The winner was indeed Ford versus Ferrari.
That's what I'm talking about.
Best sound mixing. We both went with 1917. And the winner just happened to be 1917. Best visual effects. Jamie?
1917.
Ooh. Yep. I went with The Irishman for this one. And I was incorrect. But you were right because it was 1917.
Oh, yeah.
Best adapted screenplay. Jamie?
Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah, I went with Little Women, but of course, the winner was Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, pulling away.
Yes. Let's see if I'll ever catch back up. Best original screenplay, Jamie went with?
Marriage Story.
I picked Knives Out, and the winner, again, was Parasite.
Yeah.
It's once you establish a run... you know, there's two for Parasite, so I don't know how surprised anybody can be anymore.
That's true.
Production design. We both went with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the winner was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
All right.
Best actress. Jamie, you picked?
Cynthia Erivo.
I went with Scarlett Johansson, but the winner was Renee Zellweger for Judy.
I did not see that one coming.
Nor did I. Best supporting actress. Jamie picked?
Florence Pugh.
And I had Scarlett Johansson again.
Hedging your bets.
Indeed. However, the winner was Laura Dern from Marriage Story. See, I would have been right on the movie with the first Scarlett. Oh, never mind. Best animated feature, though. Jamie, what'd you have?
Missing Link.
I picked Toy Story 4, the most mainstream choice possible.
And you nailed it.
The winner was the most mainstream choice possible, Toy Story 4. Best cinematography, you had?
1917.
I picked Joker. However, you proved to be accurate one more time, as 1917 took it.
Racket.
Best costume design. We both picked Little Women, and we both were right again.
All right.
And to finish it all out here, best director. We both picked Todd Phillips for Joker, and the winner, again, was Parasite, Bong Joon-ho.
Wow.
So the final tally, out of 19 total guesses, Jamie had 9 correct predictions, and I had 7, making Just Jamie your 2020 Nerd Bomber Podcast Academy Awards Prediction Champion.
This is a glorious, glorious day indeed.
Have you ever won a more verbose title?
Can you fit that on a plaque?
We're going to try in our imagination. So, yes, that is how this year's Academy Award prediction is shook out. And that takes us to this week's installment of...
3, 2, 1,
pop! 3, 2, 1, pop is, of course, the part of the show where we pick 3 current pop culture headlines and rank them as we see fit. Coming in at number 3 this week, it was recently determined that skull fragments discovered in 2010 in Alberta, Canada, were a completely different type of tyrannosaur than previously thought. This specimen was declared to be an older cousin of the Tyrannosaurus rex. The new creature has been named...
Thanatotheristus degrutorum.
And that, of course, means Reaper of Death.
Now that is some cool stuff right there.
Even though both creatures existed during the Cretaceous period, the older predator would have lived 79 million years ago, while the more famous Tyrannosaurus rex would have roamed the Earth 65 million years ago.
Yeah, right to the end of the dinosaur age. Right to the end. So there's a few species of T-Rex now that have been discovered. A lot of them over the years have been, you know, they would think, oh, it was a juvenile or it was a different stage of development. But now there's a few different species of Tyrannosaur beyond just the Rex. And that's Albertosaurus, Tarbosaurus, Gorgosaurus, and now this one. So there's, you know, everybody thinks Tyrannosaurus Rex, but it was just one of a few different subspecies.
And speaking of newly resurrected dinosaurs, coming in at number 2 this week, the XFL has returned to once again attempt to fill both the pro football void in the NFL offseason and owner Vince McMahon's pockets. The XFL is an 8-team spring professional football league that aims to improve on NFL football by being lesser? What that means is shorter seasons, shorter games, and faster pacing. The original XFL started in 2001 and was largely seen as a sideshow full of gimmicks and stunts, and eventually lasted only one season. However, it was responsible for several innovations later adopted by the NFL, including things like sky cams and on-field interviews that have since become standard practices.
So yeah, I kind of totally forgot it was coming until I, you know, saw on social media that people were like posting highlights and things like that at the games. You know, I'm a football fan. The NFL season's kind of enough for me. It's so ubiquitous during the season that I don't really need more. But this is an interesting attempt to make a secondary league. I mean, I think this time the XFL is coming at it with sort of the more realistic approach that we're not going to compete or replace the NFL. We want to, you know, I think they've pretty much said that they want to operate as a farm system for the NFL. And a few leagues have tried that and failed over the years. Recently, the UFL and the AAF have been recent sort of similar type leagues that have tried to work as a training ground or a minor league for the NFL, and they kind of failed quickly themselves. But the XFL is going to give it another try. Vince McMahon's going to give it another try. Their average attendance, all the games had 17,000 plus fans. And that wasn't just the average. They all had between 17,000 and 18,000. That's a pretty healthy attendance number for something like this.
Yeah.
If they can maintain that, then they'll be okay live. And if you look at the ratings, I mean, it's not that they sort of went astronomical or anything, but the opener opened at 3.3 million viewers, and that's a similar number to something like the Liberty Bowl on ESPN or Celtics versus Raptors on ESPN or Liga MX Final Leg 2 on Univision, you know, things like that, you know, other sort of, you know, tertiary sporting events it was basically running equal to. And then, of course, that was kind of like the boosting beginning number. Everything kind of leveled out after that.
Right.
But the numbers, you know, they're somewhere between 300 and 700,000 viewers at any single point. And those kind of numbers are similar to what most of these networks would be running with programming at a similar time of year, at a similar time of day. So at the very least, at least for starters, the XFL is not doing any worse than what these networks would be airing otherwise.
Yeah, interestingly enough, relevant to Vince McMahon, his NXT show is in the 700,000s on average.
And that runs every week, and there doesn't seem to be any signal that they're going to give up on that. So
that's right. Coming in at number one this week, Rage Against the Machine will tour for the first time in 10 years.
Wow.
The original lineup of drummer Brad Wilk, bassist Tim Comerford, guitarist Tom Morello, and vocalist Zach De La Roca will reunite and perform 40 shows across North America and Europe.
I have to say, it's not like I'm the biggest fan of Rage Against the Machine. I like them when I hear them. I wasn't really aware that it had been that long.
Yeah, I know they've kind of come in and out of being together, right. But I'm guessing that
the whole Audio Slave thing, you know, that was a big part of the reason why they weren't really a thing, too.
Right. And seeing as how that can't be a thing anymore.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know what kind of factors led into this. I know that they officially reunited late last year, but just recently announced a tour and decided to do it in a big and proper way. You know, as we progress through the years here, the legacy band list is kind of shrinking and, you know, somehow, you know, Kiss is finally actually wrapping up their touring, and you know, somehow the Rolling Stones are announcing another tour.
Yeah, of course.
But I mean, how many more do they really have in them? So bands from the 90s like Rage Against the Machine doing this are kind of the next tier of that.
Yeah, it's kind of freaky to think about, but it's true. I mean, guys who saw success in the 90s would be in like in their 50s now, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of like where we're at. So Rage Against the Machine is interesting. I've recently heard a lot of them because I've been listening to a Pandora station called 90s Pop Radio. But and so I know that doesn't seem to make sense, but all of the music on this station is like 90s rock bands.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess that just shows that like a lot of top 40 music in the 90s was made by bands,
you know,
by people who played the instruments and sang the songs, because it's all stuff. It's all Rage Against the Machine, and there's a lot of Beastie Boys and, like, you know, the Wallflowers and Matchbox 20 and Bush and all these things. A lot of it you'd kind of consider like alt rock or something, the kind of stuff that I'm hearing on there. But anyway, the point is that I've probably heard more Rage Against the Machine in the last couple months listening to that particular station on Pandora while I'm working out than I have in my lifetime up till now.
Then throughout the entire 90s.
So it's true. It's absolutely true.
Well, that does it for 3-2-1 Pop, but seeing as how we were children of the 90s, that brings us to our main topic. Let's talk about the things we like to read as kids. I think I started last time. Would you like to go first?
Sure. So I'm going to kind of start right off with my heavy hitter from my childhood. I'm not ranking these or anything, but in general, this is the thing that's when you first proposed this as a topic, this is the first thing that came to mind. And that is zoo books.
Okay.
Dinosaurs once ruled the earth. Today, kids pretty much run things, but animals are still number one. And only zoo books can make the world of wildlife come alive.
The children naturally love animals, and they enjoy learning everything they can about them. Here's your mail.
Whoa, zoo books.
Thanks, Mom.
See what I mean? Every month, your kids will receive a new zoo book filled with dazzling color pictures of exotic animals from around the world. They'll read incredible articles and learn fascinating facts, like why tigers might starve to death if they didn't have their stripes. I didn't know that. Get zoo books. Your kids will love them, and they'll be learning, too.
Look, Mom.
Call now, and you'll receive 12 issues for only $19.95. That's 44% off the newsstand price, less than $1.70 a month. Plus, you'll also receive a special dinosaur edition, this stunning tiger poster, and these great animal stickers.
Call 800-441-2400. That's 800-441-2400.
Call now before this offer becomes extinct.
So, I didn't read a lot of books as a kid. Not fiction, anyway. It took me a long time, basically into adulthood, before I made a regular practice of reading fiction, novels, and things like that. Short stories, even. It's not that I didn't do a lot of reading. And one of the things that started me off was having a ZooBook subscription as a kid. ZooBooks are kind of fun. They're interesting. They were started in 1980, and as of right now, there are 61 issues of ZooBooks. If you get a subscription to ZooBooks, you start at the first one, and you go through to the end. And if you keep your subscription going, it starts over. or you can get like some variant covers and things like that. Because they don't, it's not like a thing where they just keep making them brand new. Right. There are some slight updates. They've added issues over the years. Like for instance, I think they added a second horse issue that's specifically, so they separated like domesticated horses and wild horses, and they turned it into two separate issues. So there's little things like that have happened over the years. I don't think I had quite ever the full collection of ZooBooks, but I had an awful lot of them, and a lot of that knowledge, a lot of that kind of, I don't want to say it's pointless, but I've never applied it in a professional way. Animal knowledge has stuck in my head for a long time.
Yeah, they were great for that. It's a really unique way to go about publishing a magazine. I don't know if I ever knew that it worked like that, but I have fond memories of ZooBooks as well. They were just so well illustrated, and like the way they would break down the anatomy of an animal and everything, like, just was really compelling to look at.
The artwork is really kind of stunning. It's not quite photorealistic, but it's a really high level. They did have, I mean, there were pictures in it, but it wasn't supposed to be like a National Geographic where it's a trip. It's not supposed to simulate a safari photography expedition. I mean, there were pictures, but a lot of it was illustrations. And like you said, a lot of it was sort of cross sections where here's the tiger and here's the muscle layer and here's the skeletal layer and here's the internal organs of a tiger. And it really broke all that stuff down for you in pretty decent detail. I mean, I think even now, if I were to open up a ZooBook and read it, it's not like it's totally dumbed down for kids. There's a lot of technical detail in them.
I think we kind of talked about that aspect of children's entertainment several times on this show, where, you know, you used to have to, they demanded something of you as a kid. Like, you kind of had to raise to meet their level. It wasn't super lofty or anything, but, you know, it forced you to kind of learn something and to evolve a bit.
Yep.
One of the most vivid examples of that in my memory of the diagram of an animal is we had one about wolves, and I still remember they had this picture that's drawing of a wolf and kind of showing you the different areas of, like, on its fur of what it did. And I remember, like, the on its back it was called the cape, and they talked about how it acted like a built-in raincoat. And I picture that every time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was always little details like that. Like, that's where I sort of learned that polar bear's fur is kind of more translucent than white. For instance, it's like these hollow shafts, you know?
Right.
Or that's where I learned about, you know, the blubber layer, or you know, there's just all kinds of these interesting little details that you learn. All right. Your turn.
Well, my first mention here is a heavy hitter for me as well in terms of the impact it had on my formative years, and that is Disney Adventures Magazine.
Check it out!
If you love the sports, stars, action, and fun of Disney Adventures, the magazine for kids,
yes!
Then don't miss this free special collector's issue.
All right!
With an exclusive sneak peek of Disney's exciting new series, Goof Troop.
Yes!
So get your own free Disney Adventures collector's issue with the Goof Troop preview.
And here's how to get it.
Hey, kids, get your Disney Adventures free when you buy a kid's meal at all participating Burger King restaurants. Supplies are limited, so hurry into Burger King and get them while they last.
This was a digest-sized magazine covering a wide variety of mainstream entertainment, pop culture, and media news. It was focused on Disney properties, but it wasn't limited to them. I learned about a lot of things that didn't fall into the Disney purview, so to speak, including things like fashion. I didn't know what Doc Martens were until I read their little, like, What's Hot column. The same thing for some 90s lingo that, you know, looking back on it now, it seems kind of ubiquitous, but at the time, I just wasn't exposed to it. And certain TV show characters that I, on shows I didn't watch or get the channels for, I found out almost everything there was to know through reading this magazine. I first saw it on newsstands. There was an issue with Hulk Hogan on the cover, promoting his then new movie, Suburban Commando.
His finest film.
Exactly. So that caught my attention. I remember reading it in the thumbing through in the store and reading the interview with him. And specifically, I remember there was a part where he talked about his young daughter would ask him, "Dad, when are you going to have a full head of hair?" So I don't know why that just always stuck out. I was amused by that when I was a kid.
It's just been a choice all along for him.
Right.
Living the gimmick, brother.
Yeah. But the first issue I ever owned was for the release of the movie The Rocketeer in the summer of 91. I was definitely just wanted to grab up everything I could with the picture that the name Rocketeer on it in that summer. And that was one of the things. And it had a really cool little Rocketeer comic strip in it as well. That was another element of this magazine. They always had such a wide variety of things. They had comics, they had puzzles, they had articles, and you know, just everything. It really was a huge influence on me and my entertainment sensibilities. And you know, if there was a late night show about Disney Adventures content, it would have to be the Nerd Bomber podcast. It basically kind of, you know, it's one of the biggest pieces of what I try to model everything I do that is supposed to be entertaining after.
Yeah, Disney Adventures, you know, I didn't have a lot of interaction with it. I think I had thumbed through a couple issues of it in random places, you know, maybe like the doctor's office or something like that, the dentist office.
Oh, they were good for that.
Yeah. I don't think anybody I knew ever had a subscription, at least not that I was interacting with very much. I missed out on that. I missed out on a lot of sort of the pop culture media of our childhood.
Right.
Even though now I'm so into this stuff, at the time I was kind of into it in its raw form and didn't have a lot of drive to sort of dig deeper. You know, I watched the cartoon and love it because it was on.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a desire to know every detail beyond that.
Right.
So I missed out on a lot of that stuff. You know, yeah, like Disney Adventures, but later on, like as an adult, things like Mad or Cracked or Wizard or Fangoria or Entertainment or even having comic subscriptions, you know.
Right.
I read a lot of comics, but I would just kind of get them in bunches, you know, somebody would get me like a blind box for a birthday or something like that. So I never followed anything issue to issue, and I never had a subscription to any pop culture magazines like what Disney Adventures was for maybe a slightly younger crowd.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a experience that I wish I would have had. But now the whole world, every pop culture is at your fingertips. The entire collected works of humanity is at your fingertips at all times. So unfortunately, all that kind of stuff is a little bit antiquated, but I kind of missed out a little bit.
Well, Disney Adventures actually, it's, you know, like you said, it kind of served as a gateway drug to all those other magazines and all those other, like,
right,
you know, later interests. We did have a subscription, but we just pulled it off by the skin of our teeth because our grandfather for Christmas every year would get us a subscription to a kid's magazine, and for years it was always Highlights magazine.
Right.
And eventually, you know, that's a quality magazine.
Absolutely.
It's a little boring, you know, it's a little bland, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's very well done. But we just got to the point where we're just kind of like over Highlights. Mm-hmm. Like, can we just get something else, man? And somehow my mom was able to convince him to do Disney Adventures because he was adamant that it would be like primarily educational. And
right.
I guess she was able to hoodwink him. I mean, it was. I mean, Disney Adventures wasn't like rot your brain. It was definitely more entertainment. But
sure.
You know, because of that, we ended up having a good 5-year run getting a subscription of it.
That's pretty cool.
We kind of stopped getting them around 97, and the magazine itself went on for 10 more years.
Wow.
Having a 17-year run in total, 1990 to 2007. And yeah, it's something I look back on fondly. Your turn.
All right, so this one's a little bit oddball, and part of the reason it's oddball is because I don't specifically know what it was. So you got to take the Wayback Machine to elementary school library. And I had an obsession with Bigfoot, not the monster truck. Well, actually, I did kind of have an obsession with Bigfoot, the monster truck.
Now that you mention it.
But also I'm talking the cryptid Sasquatch here. And there was a book in the elementary school library that I took out basically every time I was able.
Right.
Take it out, return it, take it out again. And I found it really difficult to look it up and find out exactly what it was. I do not remember what it was labeled, what it was titled, I should say. And if you Google search Bigfoot book 80s or Bigfoot book 70s or whatever, you get 1,000 results, and it's really hard. Yeah. I've whittled it down to two possibilities, and those are: it is either a book by John Green called Sasquatch, the Apes Among Us, or a book called Bigfoot, the Yeti and Sasquatch in Myth and Reality by John Napier. It is a hardcover book the size of a novel, but it's not a novel. It's nonfiction. It's a collection of stories and, you know, fuzzy photographs and pictures of somebody holding a cast of a footprint and all those sorts of things.
Naturally.
And so all this leads to the fact that I had this weird obsession and also paralyzing fear of Bigfoot. I was obsessed with learning about it, but at the same time, I was scared that it was just going to be in my window.
Oh, yeah.
My window was, it was a first floor window, but it was raised up off the ground. We weren't, you know, there was a crawl space under the house and then the first floor.
Yep.
So my bedroom window, if there had been a Bigfoot standing at my window looking in, his face would have been right where my face is when I'm lying in the bed.
Yep.
So once it was dark outside, the last thing I wanted to do was look out my window because I had this very specific fear that I would look out the window, but it's dark. So it would take my eyes a second to adjust. And by the time my eyes adjusted, his face would be there.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very specific sequence of events that I was imagining would be scary. But that was enough for me. But at the same time, I couldn't help but get these books out and read about it and just sort of swamp my brain with even more interest, facts, and fear all at the same time.
I had a lot of similar experiences, right down to the fear of looking out the window. And at times, mine was more, it kind of fluctuated between aliens and Bigfoot. I was convinced one night I saw eyes looking in my window, two red lights that I swore were eyes.
Oh, God.
but I didn't think it was Bigfoot. I thought it was aliens at the time. But, I mean, it's really an interchangeable fear and fixation.
Right.
Because I used to look at those books, too, and I used to look at alien books, and it was always one or the other when I was a kid. Like, what am I going to freak myself out with this time? And this was usually after, you know, my dad would be watching Unsolved Mysteries, and we'd have to go right to bed after that.
It was the worst combination.
So I'm going, all right, Bigfoot's outside the window, and Robert Stack's voice is going to tell me about it.
And the fucking music to that show?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
what a terrible combination.
It was quite the childhood we had. Kids today are weak, let me tell you.
All right, I'm scared now, so we got to cleanse my palate and move on to your next choice.
Well, unfortunately, it's going to essentially continue the trend here. My next choice is, it's more of a blanket topic. It's novels by a certain author named Bruce Koval.
All right.
He, when I was a kid, as far as actual novels, like young adult novels go, he was the coolest author I could remember because he always wrote about monsters and aliens. And, particularly the My Teacher is an Alien series. The one I had was My Teacher Flunked the Planet. I think it might have been the fourth book in the series. I read all or most of them just because they had them in class or in the library. But for some reason, I ended up actually owning My Teacher Flunked the Planet.
Yeah, I think I read that one, even though, like I said, I didn't read a lot of novels as a kid. I do think I read that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think almost everybody had to right. read one of the series. I mean, they were just so... The saturation was so high back then with those. And I just loved the cover art and all of those. It was so cool. And he also, like, one of his books called The Monster's Ring was the source material for my favorite episode of a Saturday morning cartoon called CBS Story Break, where they take, it's kind of like a more advanced reading rainbow. They animate an episode based on a book.
Right.
And, you know, it was like a kid turning into a werewolf-esque monster with the magic ring. What's not to love? So, continuing the fascination with aliens and monsters, I just couldn't help but gravitate towards these. And they were written, at the time it seemed, in a really appealing way that definitely sucked you in and, you know, made you like, you knew it was coming, but you just had to read it. It's one of the first times I can ever remember wanting to read a whole book cover to cover and like actually looking forward to what happened next. It was reading longer than like things like picture books was kind of a struggle for a long time for me, and this helped break me out of that.
I'm looking at the cover right now, and yes, it definitely brings back every memory that I had of the. I'm sure you've seen it already, researching it. So yeah, I definitely read this one. I don't know about any of the rest of the series, but yeah, this one. I don't have that kind of connection to a particular author as a kid. I liked some of the stuff that you naturally come upon as a kid because you're meant to read it. You're made to read it.
Yeah.
You know, like Gary Paulsen stuff, Hatchet and whatnot. There was one, The Other Side of the Mountain.
Oh, My Side of the Mountain.
My Side of the Mountain, yeah. I found a sequel to that actually recently at like some book fair. I should have bought it.
Mm.
I always liked that one for some reason. I liked White Fang and The Call of the Wild. But there's a lot of things, those are just sort of put in front of you as a kid and you said, you need to read this.
Right.
Something like My Teacher Flunked the Planet, even though everybody was kind of like okay with you reading it because it's in the classroom, it's in the library.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was something kind of you felt like you discovered it on your own.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, it wasn't, you were never going to do like a official class project or like the whole class was never going to be assigned to read that.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, like they tricked you into thinking like, well, I could read this.
Yeah, this is more edgy than Hatchet.
Back to you.
All right, I'm up. I'm going to save the one for the end because I think we can both talk about that one pretty evenly. So I'm going to skip to a different one, and that is Sports Illustrated.
Mm.
Football fans, here it comes. Sports Illustrated gets you ready for the excitement of NFL football in this amazing new video, the 1992 Pro Football Spectacular. An action-packed preview of the 92 season. It's free with your paid subscription to Sports Illustrated, the best way to capture all the action and emotion of sports every week.
Now, of course, there was Sports Illustrated for kids back in the day, but I never subscribed to that one. I got Sports Illustrated in the early 90s, actually. I got really into sports, and I never lost my more nerdy inklings, but I also got into following sports. At one point, you know, I knew every player and number and team and whatever, you know, and all the different sports. I had my favorite, you know, tennis player and whatever, you know, and in addition to following all the major sports. And Sports Illustrated was was omnipresent in my life for a period of 10 years from the early 90s to the early 2000s, probably. And it was just always sort of this very dependable thing. It was weekly, which was cool. And, you know, this was, again, you know, all of this stuff, the whole thing with print media and magazines and everything is it's all, they fail now in the age of the internet because you can have this stuff like that. You just snap for the microphone there. That's how quick you can have it. But then, you know, it wasn't quite so gettable, so manageable. You know, they wrote up the stories based on what happened. You get them a week later. I mean, that seemed like lightning fast at the time. And so Sports Illustrated was definitely a presence in my life for a long time.
I can relate to a lot of that also. Even I, being more of a tertiary sports fan, also ended up even having a favorite tennis player. It was in the age of, are you Pete Sampras or are you Andre Agassi? And I was always Team Agassi.
Agassi all the way.
Yep.
He was cool. He was rad.
He was, like the commercials he was on for Canon cameras, he was the rebel.
Image is everything. That was the tagline.
I forgot about that. Yeah, absolutely. I was much more a Sports Illustrated for kids because it was, you know, more flashy and colorful and whatever.
Oh, yeah. It was super cool. I remember a cover that had Reggie White, and it showed him, like, taking his arm off.
Yeah,
he was a Terminator, you know.
I remember that, too.
So that was definitely – that sucked you in. So Sports Illustrated for Kids was definitely a part of my existence.
Yeah.
That was always attainable through school.
Right.
So that's why the Sports Illustrated thing was not quite as attainable. So that's why it seemed like this, you know – more mature version of it, which I mean, it literally is that.
Yeah, exactly.
But as a kid, I felt like, you know, more, I don't know, what's the word? I'm like, not quite mature is not quite the word, but more advanced or something because I was getting the real Sports
Sophisticated.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Did you ever have the football phone?
I never had any of this. I don't remember getting many of the special perks at all.
Right.
I might have got a t-shirt or something somewhere along the way.
Mm.
Most of my, you know, subscriptions were coming from fundraiser type things. So you weren't paying the full price.
Right.
You know, you weren't going to get the Sports Illustrated football phone.
Yeah.
I did get the swimsuit editions.
Excellent. Even from a young age.
Fairly young. But, you know, early on, it was almost kind of embarrassing. Like,
right.
You know, I was too shy about that kind of stuff. So I was like,
And that brings us to a different form of favorite childhood reading. Look for it on Nerd Bomber After Dark.
Nerd Bomber Max.
The last literary thing, cultural mainstay that made an impression on me when I was a kid was the concept of book orders and book fairs and those kinds of things. For whatever reason, I almost fetishized them. I looked forward to them above almost every other part of going to school when it was time to get a book order. And I don't even know how often that was. Maybe monthly? It seemed even farther apart than that in my memory.
I'm not 100% sure. I understand the way you felt about them.
Yeah.
It was just different. It was different than the regular school experience. And they made it such a focal point of your experience that, yeah, it got you hyped, man.
Yeah, it's weird. Okay, like the book orders, I think those were monthly. You'd get an order form,
right,
a couple pages, and you'd pick something out or whatever. And maybe you could get something and maybe you couldn't. You'd send away for it, turn it into the teacher. Book fairs, they must have been like maybe quarterly at most, maybe every 6 months.
Right.
And I remember a lot of them being almost like an open house. They were at night, like at school at night. You had to come back to school for them.
Yep.
And then they would have some that were just there going on during the day. And you could kind of go during like a free period or something, or go to recess or whatever, and go down in the cafeteria and go check it out. So I remember all these different versions of it. But the monthly book orders, the paper order form, is kind of the one that made the most impact on me, probably because I got to participate in that most often. And even then, it was only like one thing, maybe two things I could get. And it was mostly had a bunch of gimmicky stuff in them. Things like magic kits or, you know, dusting for fossil things or,
right,
you know, mostly like that and like cartoon character picture books. And that's probably what I got most of, honestly. Specifically, I remember getting this one Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles mini storybook. There's a lot of them. There's a series of them and they were all pretty great. But the one I got was one called A Visit to Stump Asteroid. And it's one of the wackier stories. It kind of follows how the cartoon went, where it started out very kind of straight ahead, faithful to the comic, and then got crazier and in other dimensions and into space as it went on.
Everything's a food monster.
Yeah. And this one was, they got transported to this asteroid by stepping into the mouth of a giant cow head. So I don't know what kind of acid trip the writers were on, but I remember it very well. I used to read it all the time. And when I ordered it, we were in second grade. We had a teacher named Miss Brown, and she must have just been reading like how things are written on an order form. And a lot of kids had gotten this book in class. I remember her like reading off, like, you know, Billy Teenage Ninja, Claude Teenage Ninja, and I just kept thinking, like, why is she saying it like that? it's very clear. It's right there. Just out of touch adult, you know. But that one stuck with me for some reason. And, you know, it was just this thing that, like, this ritual that I just always looked forward to. And I just loved to stare at the actual order form, imagining what I would get.
Yeah, that's my number one memory from it. Because I don't remember ever, I don't have a very strong memory or piece of nostalgia around actually ever getting anything from a book order. A lot of my memories are similar to the last thing you said, though, where it was, you know, just pouring over the catalog and being like, right, that looks cool. Maybe getting something at a book fair. But I don't actually remember pulling the trigger on ordering a book from a book ordering catalog and being excited about its arrival and being like, okay, I got this because we ordered it. I don't really remember that ever happening.
It's weird. As you were talking, I was thinking about what other things I remember it. And I guess they're all from around the same time period. That was about 1990. And the other two things I remember specifically date it to 89.
Wow.
One of them was a Karate Kid 3, like a word find book. And another one was a Ghostbusters 2 poster book. And yeah, I guess all my book order memories come from the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s.
Yeah. Well, good for you. I'm happy that you have those memories because I do not.
Yeah, it's too bad that they aren't like, you know, I mean, they're just glorified movie tie-ins.
It's not the finest of literature.
No.
So it wasn't really a part of my list proper, but it was something I wanted to mention because it was something that I used to do a lot for fun. I would almost call it a hobby of my childhood self was to read encyclopedias.
Yep.
And now, that doesn't mean I opened the encyclopedia the first page and I read it. Usually it would start for some particular reason because I wanted to know about something. Something would come up in conversation, you know, and I want to learn something about it. I want to know something about it. And this was the internet of the 80s, man, the encyclopedia. That's exactly this. And the way that I got sucked into reading encyclopedias was the exact same way that you go down internet rabbit holes now.
Exactly.
You open the encyclopedia to read about this thing you're looking for. And as you're reading it, you're reminded of something else. So you look that thing up. And that reminds you of another thing. So you look that thing up. So you start off wanting to read about raccoons, and you end up reading about the Magna Carta. You know, I mean, it could go a lot of different directions. And so I spent a lot of time, I know right where it was in the house, there was this little book, enclosed book cabinet. It wasn't really a bookshelf because there were doors on it. It closed up. And it was near our dining room table. And I would sit on the floor in front of that with the books out in front of me. And you know, because it's a lot. It's a lot. Encyclopedias, an encyclopedia set, kids, is big. It takes up a lot of space. It's a lot of big, heavy books.
Many volumes.
Yes. So you couldn't just, like, get them all out. So I would sit where they were and move from one to the next.
Yep.
As I sort of, you know, navigated my way through whatever it was that had my interest at the time. So that was like, yeah, I would almost call that a hobby, but it's not any different than the YouTube rabbit holes or the Wikipedia rabbit holes that people fall down into today.
Yeah, it's literally serving the same purpose. The same exact thing happened in my house. We didn't have a computer or anything like that, or even a concept of what that would be, really. And
you get a computer to the late 90s in my house.
Yeah, I don't think most people did.
Yeah.
Right. Then it was like, well, I'm bored. Maybe it's raining outside, or I just don't want to go outside. Let's see what's in the encyclopedia. You know, there's many books that I haven't looked at, or many parts of books I haven't looked at. And I mentioned off the air, but before we started, that one of my favorite things was to go to S and look up swords. And I don't know, just whatever other fascinations I had with, like, karate, or, you know, right. Probably aliens and monsters. You know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And they were always great for that. Yeah. Spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, I have nostalgia for it, but to do it now would be, well, an impossibility, because nobody has complete encyclopedia sets anymore.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, with everything right at the palm of your hand, you have all the information there, but it takes the physical ritual out of it.
Yeah.
Because that's part of the experience. We talked about this with renting movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just about having the movie in front of you and accessible. It was about the experience of going and choosing it and talking about what you're going to get and getting the snacks and driving home.
Right.
It was all part of a ritual.
Yep.
And it's the same thing here, where it was more of a physical ritual, because you had to go to where they were, you had to get the books out, do the searching manually. So that's the part that's lost.
Yeah.
When it's nice to have, like I said, it's nice to have the collected works of humanity in the palm of your hand. But you do miss out on a little bit of the tactile experience.
Yeah, definitely. I think most people are probably willing to trade that off for the time saving and convenience, but once in a while it would be nice to be able to revisit that, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
The last thing I have is just a quick honorable mention. A lot of the books I had and were exposed to as a kid came through this program we had at school, where you would collect and bring in soup labels and turn those in for, they had kind of like this box of prize books that you could pick out based on a certain number of labels you turned in. Do you remember that at all?
I don't know that I remember it specifically. I'm aware that we had programs like that.
Yeah.
They've always kind of existed. But I don't know. I remember things like Book It and things like that. That was a different thing.
Right, that was a different, yeah.
But I do have a vague memory of the soup label turn-in thing. I think I was always too much of a procrastinator to, like, do it. And I wasn't good at sort of planning ahead, so I don't think I ever took advantage of the opportunity to turn in our labels.
I got a bunch of books that way, but I wasn't collecting labels. Maybe my mom just did it and gave them to me. I don't know.
Right.
That's the only way that would have ever happened.
Yeah, exactly.
But I specifically remember getting, again, the movie novelization of Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, and a couple other books. One that's really cool, I can't remember the title of it, this weird little book about... what else? A little alien kid who comes down and masquerades as human, and, you know, kind of goes through human life with this other Earth kid, and then eventually has to go back home. I don't know. I guess from a very early age, was kind of tricked into getting books through really elaborate means. The books were masqueraded as rewards. But it worked.
Yep.
I became kind of more literate than the average kid at my age. I was always like 2 years ahead in literacy. If only I could have matched that with math.
Well, ditto. Yeah. I mean, similar. I don't want to be all braggy or compete with you, but it's a similar thing. Like, and again, like, I wasn't going out of my way to read that much.
Right.
Like, but I had specific things that I liked to read, and I did that a lot.
Yeah.
And because a lot of it was informational nonfiction, I guess a lot of it wasn't written to a grade level, so to speak. Like,
right.
Encyclopedias are not written to grade level, you know?
No.
I wasn't interested in reading the chapter books, although, like I said, I did read My Teacher Funked the Planet.
Yep.
But I didn't read a lot of that kind of stuff, which is written for certain age groups. So maybe that was what kind of actually helped. Even though I was less literate in terms of my knowledge of literature, I was more literate in terms of my reading level because I was just kind of reading what I wanted to when I wanted to.
Taking it all in.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here.
There's a lot of book reports. I definitely skimmed the book and just kind of squeezed by because it didn't interest me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make kids read about, you know, death of a salesman or historical events. I want to read about aliens and monsters and, you know, the effects they have on the planet and our brains.
That's right.
It seems like we've reached the end of the story for this episode of the Nerd Bomber Podcast. I've been your friend, Claude.
And I've been just Jamie.
We would like to extend to you a happy National Umbrella Day. And we will see you in the next chapter.
Later.
Nerd Bomber Podcast is a Ghost Factory Internet production brought to you by the WHAM Network.